We're doing Parshat Ki Teitze, and this week we will not have an overview because the parsha is so loaded that we'll just quickly touch on each of the mitzvot, or as far as we can go, without spending too much time on any one mitzvah, because there's just too much to discuss. I recommend you take the Sefer HaChinuch, Sefer HaMitzvot, and see for yourself the mitzvot of this week's parsha. Just see what mitzvot exist. The parasha begins with Ki Teitze LaMilchama Lo Yevecha. When you go out to war against your enemy, we encourage that war be outside our boundaries. Out, go out to war against the enemy, and Hashem will give you him in your hand. So then we have the mitzvah of Eishes Yefas Toar. If you see a beautiful girl and you desire her, then the Torah permits you to take her for a wife. The Torah doesn't recommend it. King David erred on this point. He thought that if the Torah permits it, then I can do it, and he did. The Torah gives us three mitzvos at the beginning of the parasha. The capacity to take a beautiful woman at war, the laws of having two wives where you don't like one and you'd rather give your inheritance to the other one's kids, and the Torah prohibits that. And finally, the laws of ben sorer u'moreh, what happens if there's a rebellious son? Our sages say the juxtaposition of these three mitzvos is to teach us that if you do take a beautiful woman at war, you should know that ultimately you won't like her, and ultimately the children will be rebellious. And the idea behind it is simple. When we marry a person, as the Mishnah says in Avos, there has to be a love that stems from the person, who you are and who she is. The Talmud tells us in Kiddushin that if one marries a woman solely for her wealth, he will not benefit from her wealth. The marriage will be destructive to him. He will die, she will die, and they will lose the wealth and they'll benefit nothing from it. When we marry, we have to marry for the right reasons. A man who just sees a beautiful woman and desires her, well, the Torah warns you, you can take her, but ultimately you won't like her. It won't be good for you. But why does the Torah permit you to take her? So we have a tradition that the Torah permits you to live with her once, and after that she has to do the procession. She shaves her head, she grows her nails, she sits and weeps over her family. And when you see that, then you'll be taken aback and you'll say, what do I want a girl like this for? She's crying all the time. She spends 1 month with her head shaved. And then you'll say to yourself, hey, maybe I shouldn't do it. So the Torah teaches us the way to overcome our desires. Sometimes the key is a balance. Sometimes the key is to let it get away with something, and then you can realize that you don't really want more of this. So here the Torah said, you're away from home, you're away from your family, you're at war, and you see a woman that's trying to seduce you. So the Torah said, fine, take her home, have her shave her head. You can have her after she shaves her head, after she grows her nails, after she weeps over her family for 30 days, then we'll talk. And by the time that's finished, you're not going to want it anymore. So very often that's the key to overcoming desire, saying, I'll get there, but first, and when you get through that but first, you overcome it. The Talmud says if a person knows he's going to sin, he can't overcome his desire. So he's very, very attracted to going to a brothel. So the Talmud says, fine, here's what you do. Go out of town, go to a faraway town, put on black clothes, wrap yourself in black clothes, go to a place that no one knows you and get all dressed up like that. And by the time you do all that, you're not going to want to go to the brothel. You'll realize, hey, what's wrong with me? And you'll come back home. So there are two understandings, whether you'll end up doing it or not end up doing it. One understanding says if you end up doing it, at least don't destroy your name, don't destroy your family, don't cause other people to sin. At least do it in a way that no one recognizes you. Tosfos says, no, the Gemara would never tell you to do a thing like that. The Gemara is saying, do all of that, and by the time you're done doing all of that, you won't end up doing it. But here, there's a Machlokas Bavli in Yerushalmi. When the Torah says you could take her and have her do this procession, so the Babylonian Talmud says you could sleep with her once, and after that, you got to do this whole procession and then decide if you want to marry her. The Jerusalem Talmud says, no, you don't even sleep with her once. Before you can sleep with her, first she has to do the procession and then decide if you want to marry her. So, however you go, a person is supposed to know that the key to overcoming desire is to be able to analyze things from a distance. We sometimes think that if we give in to desire, we will win. King David made that mistake. He figured if I'm promiscuous with my own wives, I'll overcome desire. And our sages say it's the exact opposite. Evel katan yesh ba'adam. God created a small limb in the human being. Masbio, if you try to satiate your desire for promiscuity, ra'ev, you'll only get more hungry. Marivo, but if you keep it hungry, hungry, you don't kill it, but hungry within a balanced framework, savad, then you'll be satiated. And this is one of the great errors that people sometimes make when they get married. It's normal that a person has all kinds of fantasies and desires, but a person has to keep them in line. And when a person thinks, if only I'll do this or that or the other thing, it's with his wife, you'll say it's permitted, right? But you also have to know that if you're looking to find a certain level of satiation, you're never going to get there. Because you'll do one thing and you'll want something else. You'll do something else, you want a third thing. That's the nature of the human being. If you keep things in check, you keep a balanced, normal married life, then a person could be happy. The Torah tells us that if a person has two wives, he has to treat his children fairly. He's not allowed to play favorites in the inheritance. If a person has a rebellious son, so the laws of the rebellious son are numerous. The Torah says the parents have to have an identical voice, an identical height. They both have to be able to hear together. There are so many technicalities. A rebellious son must eat a huge volume of meat, a huge volume of wine, and he has to have stolen from his father to fund that. And it only is applicable for the first 3 months after he brings two heirs, after he reaches the age of 13, and you have to have witnesses and the warning. So many technicalities. The Talmud says it never happened. But it's here to teach us a concept. It's here to teach us that, A, we do have to look into the future. We have to worry about where a child is headed. And B, the Talmud tells us so many technicalities. If the parents differed on things, if the parents were not equal in their education, so then we don't blame the kid completely for being a rebellious son. Yeah. Parents have to work together as a team. And when there's discord between the parents, so then that affects the child. And even if the child ends up rebellious, you don't apply these laws, because we say, hey, you guys didn't do your job as parents. The Torah tells us if a person deserves the death penalty, then we hang him. Here it's talking about a person who got the death penalty of stoning, or possibly because he blasphemed, we hang him. So we hang him after he's dead. When we hang him, we take a tree that's uprooted, meaning we don't hang him on a tree that's attached to the ground, but rather we take a piece of wood, we stick it into the ground, we hang him, and then we bury him with the piece of wood. The Torah says you may not leave the body hanging into the night. It's a desecration of the earth. You have to bury him right away. And from here we learn the halacha that we do not detain the burial of any person, specifically in Israel, but also in Chutz Laaretz. You do not detain the burial of any Jew unnecessarily. If it's necessary, it's his honor that the president will come to the funeral, his children will come to the funeral, so then there can be instances where we will push off the funeral because it's in his honor. That's what they did with Rabin. They waited. Clinton was coming. Okay, shalom chaver. That's some honor. Okay, in his honor, so they detained him. The idea that we bury the wood together with the deceased is not only a tree that he gets hung on, it's also the sword that you kill a person if he gets a death penalty with the sword, or the other instruments that are used to give the person the death penalty, we bury with him. We don't want people to point it and say, that's the tree that Joe Schmo was hung on. He was hung already. We don't have to disgrace him. We bury the tree together with him. We bury the sword together with him. There's an alternate understanding in the verse, Ki kililat Elokim talui. One understanding is it's blasphemy. People are going to say, why is he still hanging? He blasphemed. So people will say, really? You know what he said? So that's blasphemy all over again. It's like the guy who comes to the priest and says, oh, Father, I feel so bad about what I did. So he says to him, you know, you came here last week and the week before and the week before. This is already the 15th time you're coming to describe it. And he says to him, yeah, I know, I enjoy it every time all over again. So sometimes the repetition of a sin is a problem in and of itself. Now, halacha says that if someone blasphemes and then the witnesses come to court and they testify the blasphemy, so then the court has to tear their garments because they hear the testimony about the blasphemy that he said. So the repetition of blasphemy is blasphemy too. So when we bury the tree, that part of the idea is we don't want people talking about sins. We have to talk about the positive. So we don't want the tree around, and we don't want his body hanging around, and people will say, you know why he's hanging? And then they end up talking sinful things. The Torah tells us if you see your friend's lost ox...
What's the idea of hanging off?
Good question. Good question. Let's leave that hanging. The Torah tells us that if you see your friend's lost animal, would you ignore it? No, give him back to your friend. So the Torah firstly teaches us the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. You have to return a lost object. The Torah teaches us, even if your friend is lost, you got to give him directions. There's a biblical mitzvah to give directions. Don't let a person just walk around the forest all lost. And the custom is you take him by the hand and show him how to get out. The Torah words it as, v'italam tamehim. Are you going to ignore it? And we have a tradition that this teaches us that sometimes you do ignore it. There can be instances where the item he lost is something you're embarrassed to walk around with. You'd never carry that anyways. You find a bikini in the forest. You're not going to walk around with that. So there are things that are embarrassing for you to carry. You wouldn't carry it in the, you wouldn't be caught dead in the street with that. So then the halacha says you don't have to return that lost object if it's an embarrassment to you to carry it. So here we have the concept of kavod abrios, that the respect, the Torah also shows us that the Torah cares for human dignity. And if something's an embarrassment to you, that also carries weight in halacha. The Torah tells us when you carry a lost object, you wait till your brother seeks it out. And we have a tradition that this means you seek your brother out. Meaning, when a person comes to claim a lost object, we check him out. The Torah says, ask him, what sign do you have? Prove to me it's yours. This teaches us an attitude the Torah wanted us to have, not to be naive and gullible. Yes, you have a mitzvah to return a lost object. You also have a mitzvah to check out the guy, to make sure he's not a liar. The Torah tells us if you see your friends, your brothers, animals stumbling, you have to help them out. This goes back to the mitzvah of Tzar Ba'alei Chayim. We care when an animal suffers unnecessarily. If it's necessary, okay, so we wear leather shoes. You know, we do eat meat. But if it's unnecessary, so then we try to avoid it. We have a mitzvah to help the animal get back up. And again, the Torah stresses helping before the animal collapses, which is a concept when it comes to a person in business. The Torah says, you see your brother's about to collapse in business, help him out. And it's a concept also with the animal, because it's much easier to help the animal stay standing than to get back on its feet. You're going to have to take off, unpack the whole animal, and then get it standing again. Someone wanted something? Yes.
What about the respect and ass that are honest?
If they bother you, so if you have the time to scoop them up and flick them out the window, better. If you don't, then you could kill them. The Torah prohibits a woman wearing a man's clothing or a man wearing a woman's clothing. Now this includes not only clothing, but also shaving under the armpits for a man, shaving a man's arms or maybe even the legs. Things that women do, it's not only the clothing they wear. If a man stands in front of the mirror for 20 minutes fixing his hair, that would also fall under this. The Torah wanted men to behave like men and women to behave like women, men to dress like men, women to dress like women, and obviously this depends on the society you're in, as the Ran writes in Shabbos. If you're in a society like the Jews were when they left Egypt, the men were wearing earrings, the men were wearing rings, okay? If that's what society accepts, so men can wear rings. But if you're in a society where that's not acceptable, so then it falls under this jurisdiction. So even though it's a biblical mitzvah, it depends on the society you're in. We have the mitzvah of kantzipo. If you encounter a bird's nest, so you're not allowed to take the mother with the baby. So the simple understanding here is that the mother cares for the baby. So don't take the baby in front of the mother. Chase away the mother and then take the baby. Another understanding is that God didn't want us to cause species to become extinct. So God said, if you're going to take the kids, chase away the mother. Don't take the mother with the kids. But we have a Mishnah that says, Ha'omer al kantzipo yagiu rachamecha. If one stands in prayer and says, God, just like you had mercy over the bird, have mercy on me. So then we say, quiet, what are you doing? We can tell him, shh. Why do you shush him up? So there are multiple understandings in the commentary. One understanding is that we don't know the real reason behind the mitzvot. God told us to be merciful people, but that doesn't mean we can understand God's mercy. If the whole idea was mercy, then God would have us be vegetarians. I don't say that, the Ramban says that. If the idea was that God didn't want the bird to suffer, so then why do we eat the bird altogether? Obviously, on some level, God says you can make use of the bird, and on some level, God says, but chase away the mother and then take the kids. And when we come and say, just like you had mercy on the bird, have mercy on me, you're assuming that you understand God's reasoning in giving this mitzvah. And you cannot assume that. Another understanding says you don't understand any mitzvah. Meaning the first understanding that we quoted says you can't reach a bottom line. You can't say, I know exactly what God was thinking when He gave this mitzvah. There you took a step too far. When you say, have mercy on me like you had mercy on the bird, what you're saying is, I know what God was thinking when He gave this mitzvah. So that's the problem according to the first understanding. The second understanding says, no, you don't begin to understand. It's not that you don't reach the infinitesimal understanding of God. It's that you don't begin to understand God. When it comes to the mitzvahs, you have no clue what the mitzvahs are all about. God says do, you do, says the Rambam, and that understanding hasn't been accepted in halacha. Rambam says we do have some inkling of understanding what the mitzvahs are. And maybe like the first opinion we said, we don't have the infinitesimal understanding, but some understanding we do have. So there is an opinion in the Mishnah that says you have no clue, and the Rambam says we don't accept that opinion. The Torah tells us you will have longevity if you keep this mitzvah. There was a man named Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya, a giant of Jewish history. He was the Rebbe of the great Tana Rabbi Meir. We're talking about a giant. One day he sees a kid whose father tells him, could you go get me some birds up there in the tree? The kid starts climbing the tree. He's fulfilling two mitzvahs, Kibbut Avim and Shiluach HaKen. Two mitzvahs that the Torah attests, you do them and you'll have longevity. He gets the eggs and then a snake bites him and kills him. He falls off the tree dead. Elisha ben Avuya sees that and he becomes an apostate. He says, can't be. The Torah said two mitzvahs will grant you longevity. He was busy doing both and he died doing both as a kid. So we say that when the Torah tells us you'll have longevity, it's not talking about this world. It's talking about the world to come. We don't know how God pays back in this world. The Torah tells us if you build a house, so then make yourself a ma'akeh. You have to have a railing on the roof. Now, you live in the house. We're talking about a roof that's accessible, right? You know, you have these slanted roofs that you never go up there except for when you have to fix the slants on the roof. So that doesn't need a ma'akeh. It has to be a roof that's accessible. But even a roof, you don't spend your life on the roof. You spend your life in the house, and sometimes you use the roof. The Torah says you have to have a railing. And here the Torah is teaching us an attitude. The Torah says you may not leave something in your house that's a danger. Our sages said you're not allowed to have a ladder in your house that is unstable. You'll tell me, but who uses the ladder? I use the ladder. And I know how to be careful. And how often do I use a ladder? Our sages say exactly. That is biblically prohibited from leaving in your home. You're not allowed to have a dog that can scare people. Meaning if you have a vicious dog and it is not clear to all the onlookers that he is not dangerous, that is prohibited. Why? Because a pregnant woman might walk by and he'll come charging at her and she won't see that he can't make it to hit her. And she'll get so scared she'll jump, and when she jumps she can miscarry. So you'll tell me, how often does a pregnant woman walk by and not see that the dog can't attack her? The halacha says no. You have to have shackles on that dog in a way that it is evident to every passerby that he is not a danger. And if you don't, it's a transgression of this commandment. Meaning, the Torah was teaching us a level of sensitivity. We have to prevent any potential for harm. Not something that will clearly cause harm in the home. Of course you're not allowed to leave that in the home. The idea is something that can potentially, in the long run, cause harm is prohibited in the Torah. Lo tizrak al mecha kilayim. The Torah prohibits planting crossbreeding in our vineyard. Meaning, if you have a vineyard, you're not allowed to plant wheat and barley together in that vineyard. That's called kilayim in the kerem. And if you do, you have to burn it. When does it become kilayim? When it grew 1/200th of its growth. Which our sages said, you gauge how long it takes it to grow, and then you gauge how long it takes it to grow 1/200th, and then that prohibits the vegetable that was growing there, or the grain that was growing there, and the grapes all around it. Yes.
So that's
1/200th of growth? I don't know if it takes one day or 3 hours. I don't know. It depends on
it's
what plant.
Day,
what?
Day.
I don't know how long. I don't know. Some things probably grow. The average season for the average plant is how long? You'd say it's about 6 months? I think less. I think most things, tomatoes grow in a month and a half, 2 months? No? What? Okay, so you're saying wheat and barley is 6 months. So 6 months is 180 days. So 1/200th of that is less than a day. Okay. Pretty fast, yeah. We're not allowed to plow with two types of animal, an ox and a donkey. So the truth is any two types of animals are prohibited. But the Torah delineates an ox and a donkey. Now these are the prototypical animals. In Shabbos when it says, let your animals rest, it says the ox and the donkey. So whenever we want to say any animal, we say the ox and the donkey. And the truth is that the ox and the donkey represent the two extremes of the animal. The ox is the king of the animals. In the vision of Ezekiel, he saw the different faces of the angels. One of them had the face of an ox. So the ox is the king of the animals in that sense. The donkey is the lowest animal. The Egyptians are compared to the donkey, the most defiled animal. The donkey comes from the word chamor, from the word chomer, the most physical of the animals. The Torah says don't combine the two in plowing. So on an idealistic level, the Torah is telling us a concept. The ox chews its cud. The donkey does not. So the ox is going to eat before it starts plowing, and it's going to keep eating all day long because it's chewing its cud. Its neighbor, the poor donkey, is standing next to it salivating. He's got nothing to eat. The Torah says, don't do that to the donkey. The ox works much stronger than the donkey does. So the Torah says it's not fair. They're both attached to the same plow. The ox is going to kill the donkey. It's hard work. You're not allowed to plow with two animals together. You're not allowed to wear shatnez. What is shatnez? Wool and linen that's mixed. If you have a suit, that's an expensive suit. We once got a donation here in the Machon. You guys know I get suits and all kinds of clothing that we give out at almost no cost or at no cost whatsoever. So we once got an $800 suit. So I told the guy who took it, I said, you can only take it if you get a shatnez checked. Because an $800 suit, likely that it has shatnez. The more expensive suits, they do use wool and linen. And what do you know? The guy took it to be shatnez checked, and it has shatnez. The only time I ever saw a suit that had shatnez. And he had to pay 150 shekel, still a good deal, 150 shekel to remove the linen lining. And he got an $800 suit for 150 shekel. It's not bad, still a good deal. So you do have to check things for shatnez, and you have to know what needs to be checked. Generally today, people check everything. But you'll ask your local Orthodox rabbi if you have a tight budget, whether that's absolutely necessary. If you're buying an expensive suit, you have to check. If you have pants that are all polyester, you don't have to check them. You have a suit that's all polyester, you don't have to check it. You have a suit that has wool in it, then you're starting to talk. You have a linen suit, then you for sure have to check it, because sometimes they use wool strings to sew the buttons. There was a time that they were using linen strings to sew the buttons, so then you have a problem with a wool suit too. So shatnez is prohibited, and it's prohibited not only when we wear it, but also when we lie down on it, meaning if you have a blanket that's wool and linen mixed, so the fact that when you lie on a blanket, the blanket envelops you, that's also considered like you're wearing the blanket. And that's why you'll see that when you buy mattresses here in Israel, some of them have a hechsher, because in Europe, it turns out that they were making some of the mattresses out of shatnez. In Europe, they would have mattresses that had wool and linen sewn into the mattresses. So that's why in Israel, they started having hechsherim on the mattresses too, because even though in the United States, I never heard of this being an issue, but here in Israel, where a lot of the import is from Europe, so before you buy a mattress, you should check that it doesn't have shatnez, because that's the prohibition of shatnez. The Talmud says that when you lie down on soft shatnez, that's the prohibition of shatnez. The Talmud even says they used to have drapes, and sometimes those drapes were made of shatnez. And the servant, when he was off duty, would stand by the drapes and warm himself up on the drapes. It was like a convenient type of blanket. And if the drapes were shatnez, then you'd have a problem. So we have to be careful. Shatnez, today, I think the prime areas where you find it are suits, women's clothing sometimes have shatnez, and mattresses. The OU came out a few years ago saying that there's a problem of shatnez in ties. I checked about 100 ties. I didn't find one with shatnez. They said the prime problem were ties coming out of Spain. I checked ties coming out of Spain. I didn't find any. But they say there's a problem. So what do I know? You got to be up to date. What? I don't know how to check, but there's a person in town that checks, there's a person in Masharm that checks, there's a person in Masharm that checks. I don't know. It's not very expensive. I mean, we have a mitzvah of tzitzis in our parasha. The Torah says the tzitzis are on the four corners of the garment you wear. Any four-cornered garment is required to have tzitzis. If you buy yourself a poncho, you got to wear tzitzis. If the poncho has corners. The Torah tells us that if a person seduces a girl, so then he is obligated to marry her if she wants to. The Torah tells us there's a prohibition of a person marrying into Israel if he is a ptsu'a daka, meaning if his male gonads were either sliced or bashed, or if he has a klut shofha, where his male organ was sliced. So the Talmud says in their days already, they knew how to cure this medically. Today for sure they know how to sew things up. For a klut shofha, a person that has a slice in his male organ. The halacha says when you go to the restroom, so men should ensure that they either go sitting, that's the best way, even if they're only emitting fluids, or if they're standing, then they should make sure to wipe the place after them, because if he walks out of the bathroom and people see a puddle after him, or even a small puddle, people are going to say, ah, he dribbles, he can't have kids. Who had his kids? He didn't have his kids, someone else had his kids. So you don't want people to say that about your kids. So the Talmud says a person should take care not to leave a puddle. Today, you have to take care not to leave a puddle because you're getting the next guy wet. It's not a nice thing. Okay. The Torah prohibits a mamzer from marrying into the Jewish people, even 10th generation. What's a mamzer? A mamzer is a child that was born from a union of two people that is prohibited with the punishment of kares. Meaning, if a man and a woman have a child, but they never got married, the child isn't a mamzer. If a non-Jew has relations with a Jewish woman and has a child, that's not a mamzer. A mamzer has to be a relationship that's prohibited with the punishment of kares. What would be an example of that? A man sleeps with his sister, a man sleeps with a married woman, a man sleeps with his aunt. There are examples of things that are prohibited. You have a long list in the end of Achrimos and Kedoshim. Those relationships that are prohibited. The most classical problem is if a woman cheats on her husband. So then that's where a married woman, the child is a mamzer. The most classical problem is if a woman has an Orthodox wedding and never bothers getting an Orthodox get. She never bothers getting an Orthodox divorce. And then she has children after that. So then those children are mamzerim. That's a big problem. There's a question whether we're doing a couple a favor by giving them an Orthodox wedding, if there's room to think that if they ever break up, they won't get an Orthodox divorce. Being that today over 50% of the marriages end up in divorce, so then you have to ask yourself, are you really doing them a favor by giving them an Orthodox wedding? If chances are they're not going to spend their whole life together, those are the statistics today. So then if she won't get an Orthodox divorce, what's going to happen? Any children she has from anyone else are going to be mamzerim. They can't marry into the Jewish people. So that's a big question today. Yeah. By the way, you should just know that there are a lot of organizations in the U.S. especially, because that's where this is the most prevalent problem. There are organizations that will arrange a get very quickly and very easily for people who are in this predicament. I've been a witness on such gittin, where there was a couple that separated 10 years earlier, and then someone heard about it and said to the woman, look, any person you're going to marry now and any child you're going to have now will not be able to marry into the Jewish people. Why don't you get an Orthodox divorce? And very often, if the woman hears it's not such a big deal, we can arrange it. So there are people who will take care of that in the U.S. Yes?
So,
I don't think so.
A Jew.
What do you mean a Jew ben goy?
Jewish, the father is not Jewish. The mother is married.
He could be.
So that is a mamzer?
I think so. The Torah prohibits Ammon and Moab from marrying into the Jewish people, and the Torah says the reason is because they boycotted us. They wouldn't give us bread and water. So God holds it against them. Ammon and Moab come from Lot. Lot was taken under Avram's wing. When he was orphaned as a young kid, his father Haran passed away. So Avram took him and brought him up. He took him into his own home. Now these two nations who owe all of their existence to the Jewish people, when we pass by, they boycott us. So Hashem says, okay, and they also hired Bilam to curse us. Hashem says, we don't let them marry into the Jewish people. Now we're talking about the men of Ammon and Moab. The women are allowed to marry into the Jewish people. When Hashem describes what Bilam did, Hashem says that he overturned Bilam's curse into a blessing. So there's a machlokas in the Medrash. Did Bilam bless us or curse us? One understanding says Bilam cursed. But every time Bilam said a curse, Hashem would switch around the words and turn it into a blessing. The other understanding says Hashem overturned it in his mind. The prophecy Hashem gave him was a blessing. But there's a machlokus, what actually happened there? Because here it says Hashem overturned the blessing into the curse into a blessing. Well, if there never was a curse, then he can't really overturn it. The Torah says, "Lo tidrosh shelomam v'tovatam kol yamecha leolam." Do not seek out their peace. And King David erred in this. That when there was an Ammonite king who had helped him out, he had saved his relative, and when he passed away, so King David sent words of comfort to his son who took the throne. His son received the men, and then his advisor said, "Hey, it says in our parsha that a Jew is not allowed to seek out the peace of an Ammonite or a Moabite. You think King David really means you well? For sure he sent these people here as spies. You have to show him that you're up to his tricks." So what did they do? They shaved off half their beards and cut off half their clothing and sent them back like this. King David meant well. Our sages say, why did this happen? Because he erred. The Torah does say, do not seek out the peace of the Ammonites and Moabites. After the Ammonites did this, they said to the king, you know, now that we did that, there's for sure going to be war. And then they hired mercenaries, they hired armies from the neighboring towns, from the neighboring countries, the Arameans and others, and then they went on the attack. They figured, what should we wait for? King David sent out his men, and at that war we almost lost everything. At that war they tricked us, they ambushed us, and the Jewish army was caught on both sides, both fronts, and that's where Yoav told his brother Avishai, "You take this battalion, I'll take that battalion. Chazak v'nit chazak ba'adameinu. We have to strengthen ourselves on behalf of the nation, because if we lost, that's it. Israel is finished." So all of the Jewish people were in danger because King David erred on this pasuk. He thought to be extra nice, and he sent a message of condolence to the Ammonite king. The Torah tells us, you know, the nation of Edom, they're your relatives. You shouldn't treat them with complete disdain. You know, the Mitzrim, don't treat them with complete disdain. You were a guest in their territory. Rav Pesin Zatzal used to say, this pasuk we have to view as if the Torah would say, when you see a German, don't treat him with complete disdain. You were a guest in their territory. Either gazed us. So you'd say, that's it. I don't buy German products. I don't talk to a German. I hate him. I'd kill a German if I could. No. The Torah says you have to look back and say, wait a second, they did do something positive for me. I was a guest in their territory. And that's a brilliant view that the Torah teaches us. The Torah teaches us you have to be able to have appreciation for the good that you had. The Egyptians murdered our children. They threw them into the Nile. They threw them into the mortar. They tortured us. They wanted to kill us. They wanted to kill all the men. And yet the Torah says you cannot have complete contempt for them because you were a guest in their territory. There was a time when you had nowhere to go and you ended up by them. And so the Torah says a third generation Mitzri may marry into the Jewish people. Look at the beautiful balance the Torah teaches us. On the one hand, first two generations not, but third generation may. Now the Talmud tells us that when Sanherib came and conquered country after country, Mitzri is Egyptian. When Sanherib, what?
Right.
Yes. When Sanherib came and captured most of the Middle East, maybe all of the Middle East. So Sanherib would exile every country in order to ensure that they don't revolt against him. He'd exile them and situate them elsewhere. And when he did that, he caused such mass confusion in the world that after the period of Sanherib, we no longer have anyone that we could validate as an Ammoni, Moavi, Mitzri, Amaleki. And that's why all these halachos today are not imposable. Meaning, they are still relevant. They're part of the Taryag. They're part of the Taryag because they're eternal. But our capacity to implement them has been hindered because we can't know anymore who is an Ammoni, Moavi, Mitzri, or Amaleki. So we have to assume that most of the world are not any of the above. And so anyone that comes to become a ger, we assume, is not one of the above. And we accept him as first generation as a Jew. Yes? That was before the Torah was given. The Torah says when you go out to war, you have to be extra careful not to do things that are bad. Meaning, when you go out to war, it's a time of danger. And in a time of danger, so you have to be extra careful that you should have merits. What happens if a person is impure? So he goes out of the camp. Well, I'm missing a few pages in my Chumash. How do you like that? Toda Rabba. If a person is impure, the Torah says, Mikerei Laila, from an occurrence of the night. The Torah repeatedly teaches us to talk Bilashon Nikiya, to talk in a clean tongue. Meaning, the Torah could have said he slept with his wife, the Torah didn't. The Torah said, an occurrence of the night. Doesn't say what happened. What's the occurrence of the night? So we all know what that means. That's what we call Tumas Keri, the defilement of something that happened. What happened? No, we all know, but we're not going to spell it out. That's the pure language that the Torah wanted us to speak. When we speak about intimacy, we say, Tashmi Shamita, the use of the bed. What'd you do there? Ah, we don't use those words. People sometimes say, why are you embarrassed to say this word or that word or the other word? Why shouldn't I be embarrassed? The Torah didn't want me to use those terms. The only time we use those terms is in order to learn Torah. If sometimes a student won't understand the words of the Torah accurately or swiftly, so then we use the most accurate way to describe what the Torah is saying. And that's why we will sometimes use these terms. But if it's not necessary, so then the Torah told us to try and use Lashon Nikiyah. The Torah tells us someone who is Tamei Tumas Keri, he goes to mikveh, and then at nightfall he becomes pure. Today there is no biblical obligation for anyone to go to mikveh, any man to go to mikveh, because we don't ascend the Temple Mount, we don't have any of the mitzvahs of Kerbonos, none of this is relevant to us. There is an opinion that says that every Jew should become tahor for the holidays, for the regalim, and that's why there used to be a custom that everyone goes to mikveh before Rosh Hashanah, before the three holidays, and there was even a custom to make a blessing on that tevilah. We don't rule like that opinion, so we do not make a blessing on that tevilah, but many people still have the custom to go to mikveh before Rosh Hashanah and the three regalim, and that's based on a pasuk that says every Jew should be pure. So our sages ask, does every Jew have a mitzvah to be pure? What's the prohibition to be defiled? So our sages say yes. Before the holidays, you have a mitzvah to be pure. We have a tradition that that's only when you're bringing sacrifices on the holidays. Today, that we don't bring sacrifices on the holidays, we don't have that mitzvah anymore. And nonetheless, there is the custom. Yes? Converts go to the mikveh, it's a totally different immersion. The immersion of a convert going to a mikveh is part of the process of his becoming Jewish. Just as the Jewish people at Sinai all brought a sacrifice, so too every convert has to bring a sacrifice. Just as they all accepted the mitzvot, every convert has to accept the mitzvot. And just as they all went to mikveh, so too every convert has to go to mikveh. Today we don't have a sacrifice, so the Talmud spends a good deal of ink explaining why is it that you could have converts if you can't have sacrifices. So the Talmud proves that that's not obligatory. The Jewish people were all circumcised as part of the process of becoming Jewish. Every convert has to circumcise as part of the process of becoming Jewish. And the circumcision, the accepting of mitzvot, and the mikvah are a mandatory part of the conversion process. The sacrifice is only mandatory when it's possible. When it's not possible, no. There was once a huge donor who had a big factory, and he had some kind of heart condition. And so I don't remember if he couldn't circumcise or he couldn't go to the mikveh, one or the other. This story goes back to Europe about 150 years ago. So he converted, and the rabbi wrote him a letter explaining why his conversion was kosher, even though he didn't, I don't remember which one of the two he couldn't do. And then, I think, maybe it was Rav Chaim Oizer, one of the big rabbis of Europe of 100 years ago, was once in his factory. He was there giving him a donation. And he looked at his wall and he saw a letter in the frame. So he asked him, what's that? He said, oh, well, that's my letter approving my conversion, even though I didn't, one of the two, I don't remember which one, either circumcise or go to mikveh. Because I can't. I have this heart condition, I can't. So the rabbi read it. And the rabbi said, I'm sorry to inform you, but you're not a Jew. Here he was going to give him a donation. And then he wrote a letter to the Rav. I don't remember who. I think it was Rav Shlomo Levilna, but I'm not sure. Who wrote that letter permitting him to convert without it. He said, just like the sacrifice isn't mandatory, so too this isn't mandatory when you can't do it. And he wrote him a whole long letter explaining to him why he was wrong and asking him never again to rule in halacha. He said, you got it wrong, and you told the person he's Jewish. When he's not Jewish, don't paskin anymore. Give shiurim, but don't paskin. And so that's that. At any rate, those two are mandatory. Mikvah and bris milah. The conversion was not kosher, correct. Those are mandatory. He has to accept the mitzvah, has to do milah, has to go to mikvah. And if he can't because of a heart condition, that's a problem, but he can't convert. So we have a mitzvah that when we go to war, we have to set a place as a bathroom. People don't just go in the middle of the camp. God says your camp has to be holy. I am in your camp. And our sages learned from this pasuk that when it says your camp is not only a reference to the camp at war, but every Jew, his location is called your camp. And Hashem is with every Jew. So this halacha that says, your camp is holy and I am there, we apply halachically, we apply it to mean every Jew is considered the camp in which Hashem is present. And so when we want to talk Divrei Torah, we're not allowed to talk Divrei Torah when there's something defiled in our camp. What does that mean? Within our Dalit Amos, if there's any feces or any urination, or something else that's defiled and has a very foul smell, so we're not allowed to talk Divrei Torah, we're not allowed to make a blessing or pray in that circumstance. What happens if a person's in shul and there's a bad smell? Someone caused a bad smell, so then the halacha says he may not continue his Shemona Esrei or his Shema. You're allowed to learn Torah when someone else caused a foul smell, but you're not allowed to daven. You're not allowed to say any part of davening. You have to pause and wait for the smell to pass. The person himself who emitted the smell, so he's not allowed to even learn Torah. Other people are allowed to learn Torah, but not to daven or say any blessings. The Torah tells us if during the war a slave runs away from the enemy and comes to us and wants to join our camp, you're not allowed to give him back. He wants to accept Judaism, monotheism, you're not allowed to send him back to his rightful owner. Now, this is an error that Abraham made. When Abraham won the war against the four kings, so of Sodom and Amorah, all the people were his. He was the rightful owner. Along comes the king of Sodom and Amorah and says, you keep the wealth, I take the people. And Abraham said, you keep the wealth and the people. And God says to Abraham, or about Abraham, how could you do that? How do you give him back to that king? So you didn't want to benefit from the war, but who allowed you to give him away from monotheism? And in truth, we see that 26 years later, all of them died when Sodom and Amorah were overturned. So here we have a mitzvah. The Torah says you're not allowed to give the slave back. The Torah prohibits a woman from being a prostitute or a man from being a prostitute. Now this applies not only to prostitution, but also to situations where a woman lives with one person and then after 2 weeks goes and lives with someone else. Aside from the mitzvah that you only live with a woman after you have a proper marriage, there's another prohibition that prohibits prostitution. And prostitution is not only a woman who's a one-night stand, but even if it's going to be a two-week stand, so long as it's short-lived, that's this included in this prohibition. And that's part of the idea that the Torah prohibited a divorcee who got remarried from ever going back to her first husband. The Torah didn't want us to find a loophole where you marry a woman, no problem, you bring two witnesses, you do kiddushin, you marry her, you live together for 2 weeks, and then you go on to the next one. You divorce her, she goes on to the next guy. 2 weeks later, you want to sleep with her again, so you say, okay, I'll marry you again. Says the Torah, no. Once a woman is divorced and married someone else, she may never go back to her first husband. The Torah did not want people to go back and forth. The Torah wanted us to be consistent with one wife. The Torah says if a prostitute wants to give a donation to the temple, it may not be an animal that was given to her as payment for her services. Meaning, she might want to redeem herself, so to speak. Very often when a person does something destructive, they want to do something positive with it. People steal money, they have a Ponzi scheme, so they donate to YU $100,000 and now they're a kosher Jew. The Torah says, no, you're not allowed to accept that money. When a person's a sinner, you're not allowed to benefit from his sins. And if a person is raising evil dogs in his house, so those dogs are used to hurt people. And then he'll say, you know what? One of those dogs, when I sell it, I'll give a contribution to your yeshiva. Torah says you're not allowed to accept a contribution to the temple from someone who got that money by selling an evil dog, a dog that's harmful to society. So it could be harmful to society because of what she's doing, because of the dogs he's raising, Notice that the Torah juxtaposes her and her dog. God says they're both an abomination before God. The Torah says that you're not allowed to lend with interest to a fellow Jew. You're allowed to lend with interest to a non-Jew. And the idea is very simple. The Torah says technically money is worth money. Technically you should collect interest. Technically that's a good way to run business. Good for you and good for the borrower. But what? We have this club called the Jewish people. If you're a member of the club, then you may not give with interest. You may not collect with interest. When it comes to someone who's not a member of the club, well, he's allowed to collect interest from you, right? So then you're also allowed to pay interest to him. It goes both ways. Just like I'm allowed to pay him interest, I'm allowed to collect from him interest. A fellow Jew, I'm not allowed to pay or collect. It is a sin for both. It is a sin for the person who pays interest. It is a sin for the person who collects interest. Two ways. God says, you think that if you don't collect interest, things won't go good for you. I give you special blessing that whatever you do will be successful. You will be successful in your business. If you take a vow, we have a prohibition, lo ta'achir l'shalemo. You may not detain in paying it. Hashem says, if you detain in paying it, God holds it against the person. And God doesn't want us to take vows. It is considered a sin to take a vow. If one took a vow, he has an obligation to fulfill that vow. The Torah tells us if you're working for someone with food, and you're working with food that's a final product that's edible, so then the employer must allow the workers to eat from the food. You're not allowed to have people working with final product food and not give them to eat. Let them eat from that food too. Special halachas on this, but that's not halacha. The Torah warns you that you can't take advantage of it. You can't come and bring your basket and just fill it up and bring home food for the kids. No, but you have to let your workers eat from the food. The Torah tells us if a man marries a woman, he can marry her by giving her money or the equivalent. That's how we marry today. There are two stages to marriage, Kiddushin and Nisuin. Kiddushin is that he is designating her as his wife. From the minute he is Mekadesh her, she is his wife, and biblically prohibited upon anyone else. If anyone else wants to live with her, it is Yaharik Val Yavar. They should rather die than do that. It is one of those prohibitions. But the final stage of marriage is Nisuin, when he takes her under the chuppah, when we have the final stage of marriage. Technically, after they did the first stage called Kiddushin, they are wed. There are certain technicalities, monetary issues about inheritance, about redeeming her. There are technicalities where they're not yet as obligated to one another. But they're not yet fully married. There are not yet. After Nisuin. I don't think so. After Nisuin. There are certain technicalities and monetary issues where they're not fully married till they do Nisuin, the second stage of marriage. But the rabbis were scared of us men. The rabbis said, men are going to want to leave their marriage at the stage of Kiddushin, where they're less obligated monetarily to the woman. So the rabbis said that a woman who is only Mekudeshet to her husband, he didn't do the second stage where he completely obligates himself financially to the woman, so then the woman is prohibited upon him like a Nida. He may not live with her ever. Not once, not twice, not ever. Till you do Nisuin. That was the rabbi's ways of ensuring that he fulfills his obligations and they protect the women. Now, the rabbis worded it nicely. The rabbi said, Kala belo bracha asura lebaala kenida. They didn't say a kala without Nisuin. They said a kala without the blessing. What's the blessing? That's the blessing that we make with Nisuin, the Sheva Brachos. The Sheva Brachos that come with Nisuin. They said, before Sheva Brachas, she's prohibited like a Nida. You're not allowed to live with her at all. But that was the rabbinic institution. Technically, biblically, they're permitted the second they do Kiddushin. How do you do Kiddushin? One of three ways. Either by being intimate, meaning they have two witnesses. The two witnesses see them going into the room, and he says, I'm going into the room and we're going to have Kiddushin by being alone together. The second way you could do Kiddushin is by writing a contract. I hereby engage you. And you give her the contract. The third way, which is the way we employ today, is by giving her something of a minimal monetary value. You're not buying her. What you're doing is you're acquiring the right to be her husband, the right to do Nisuin. So the Kiddushin is really an act where you're buying the right to be her husband. You're not buying her. She's worth much more than any money you'll give her. You're giving her that ring as the right to do nisun with that woman. So that's kiddushin, one of three ways in which you acquire the right, or you form a contract of connection to ultimately do nisuin. So we have three ways of doing kiddushin. The Torah says, how do you get divorced? So it's interesting. Only at the end of the 40 years in the desert do we entertain the concept of divorce. There's discussion among the commentaries. Did the concept of divorce exist during the 40 years of the desert, or prior to the giving of the Torah? May a non-Jew divorce his wife? The Torah discusses the capacity of marriage by Jews, but who said there's the capacity for divorce? Maybe you're stuck with your wife forever. Maybe the Christians have it right. So we derive from different sources that there is such a concept of divorce among non-Jews as well. The Torah says, when does he divorce her? If he finds something that's wrong, something that's despicable, something that is immodest. He's not sure if she's cheating on him. She's walking around the streets not dressed modestly. She's joking around with the guys and she's flirting with them and he has to wonder what's going on. So there's a machlokas among our sages. When the Torah says those are the grounds for divorce, was the Torah saying those are the only grounds for divorce? That you may not divorce a wife unless you see there's something immodest that you have to wonder how faithful she is? Or was the Torah just giving us an example of what the Torah expected would be grounds for divorce? But technically, if you want to divorce her because you like your neighbor better, you're allowed to do that. The halacha is you don't have to give any grounds for divorce. The halacha is if a person wants to divorce his wife, he may do so for whatever reason. The Torah looks down upon a person who would do that. It is the greatest harm you could inflict upon someone else. To hurt someone's feelings and tell them that you want to get divorced, that might fall under many other prohibitions of hurting someone's feelings. But technically, legally, if a person wants to get divorced, he doesn't have to justify his reason to the courts. For whatever reason he wants, he may get divorced. It does not have to be that he says, well, I have reason to suspect that. We rule that they may get divorced for any reason they see fit. Now, Rabbeinu Gershom made a pact that you don't divorce a woman against her will. Just like a woman can't force a man to get divorced, the rabbis imposed the cheirem that you can't divorce a woman against her will. So sometimes you're going to have a wise aleck woman. She's going to say, okay, give me $3 million and then I'll agree to accept the divorce. So Rabbeinu Gershom imposed another clause. He said if there are instances where the courts see that the husband is legitimate in wanting the divorce, and the woman insists, I don't want to receive the divorce, so then he may get a heter me'er rabbanim. He could get 100 rabbis from different countries to sign on an agreement that they allow him to divorce her against her will. And the idea of getting 100 rabbis from different countries is to ensure that someone who has political clout or could present his story in a specific way and convince the rabbis of his town, he won't get away with it. Rabbeinu Gershom wanted to ensure that this clause would only be used in a situation that's crystal clear that he has the right to get divorced even though it's against her will. So that's the heter me'er rabbanim, the capacity that a husband has to get 100 rabbis to sign on a document that permits him to divorce his wife against her will. Biblically, he may. Rabbinically, he may not. But rabbinically, there is that clause where necessary. What happens if a woman's being beaten by her husband or some other terrible situation where she has a right to demand divorce? So then the rabbis take the husband and they beat him up and they say, the Torah demands of you to divorce your wife. She wants out. And the husband says, but I don't want to. So they pick up baseball bats and they start hitting him. And they say, now do you want? So he can say yes, he could say no. Sometimes they'll dig a pit and they'll tell him, okay, now you get down there and we're going to start beating you and you're going to have one of two choices. Either she gets free because you divorce her, or she'll get free because you're going to end up there at the end of the night. And they pick up the baseball bats, and it's his choice. How is he going to free his wife? Now, you'll ask me, what's the whole idea here? The idea is that a husband may only divorce his wife of his own volition. Now, every Jew deep down inside wants to do what's right. Sometimes there's a lot of schmutz, there's a lot of dirt that clouds our vision, and we don't realize that we want to do what's right. So sometimes it takes a few baseball bats to remind us that we want to do what's right. So this sounds like semantics, but the truth is it isn't. It's giving us a tremendous insight into our soul. We're approaching the month of Tishrei. Sometimes a person might think about himself, I'm a bum, I'm an evil person. Comes the halacha and says, no, every single Jew at the core is a good person. The only question is, how do you get to that core? Sometimes it takes a few baseball bats to get there. But the halacha is real. The halacha says that She's not divorced if he didn't do it of his own volition. So you'll ask me, you know and I know, he didn't want to do it. It was the baseball bat that made him say yes. But he didn't want to do it. The halacha says no, he did want to do it. Deep down inside, every one of us wants to do what's right. And that's a very important approach to ourselves. Forget our fellow man, to ourselves. Every one of us deep down inside is good. Sometimes it doesn't come to the surface so easily. So we have to figure out how to get it there. But the halacha says, when he says yes, and he gives her that divorce contract, we're saying that's the real him coming out. If the rabbis were so convinced that she's in the right in demanding a divorce, to the point where they picked up baseball bats, then the real him says, I want to do what the halacha says. And that's what's coming out at the courtroom. The Torah tells us, if a man divorces his wife because he was suspecting that she's so immodest he can't know what's going on, so then, A, he has to give her a contract that completely divorces her. The Torah says when there's divorce, it must be kritut, complete severing. There are no more ties anymore. The idea is, she's free, you're free. But there, it has to be a complete severing. There cannot be stipulations. He can't write a divorce contract with the following stipulation. You are divorced from me unless you inherit $1 million. Well, she might inherit $1 million in a year, in 10 years, you never know, right? She's not divorced. Divorce, by definition, must be what the Torah calls sefer kritut, a document that severs, and the severance must be complete. When she gets divorced, the Torah says she goes and marries someone else. The Torah calls this other person ish acher, the other person. The Torah is telling you the first husband was a tzaddik. When he saw his wife was immodest, at some point he said, we can't continue like this. Why'd the second guy marry her? Because he's an other person. He's not the same tzaddik as the first one. One of the most important things we have to look at when we're thinking of marriage is that the woman is someone that you can trust is going to be faithful, that she has that modicum of modesty that you can be comfortable, that you know things are the way they should be. And if a person doesn't have that, then the Torah calls him an ish acher. He's another person. The Torah says, what happens if the second husband hates her? Well, surprise, surprise. Wants to divorce her or he dies? So then the Torah says the first husband may not remarry her. We're up to Shishi. The Torah says, when a person is newly married, so then he doesn't go out to war. He has to be home the first year and keep his wife happy. So there's a special mitzvah the first year. We encourage a person to be home at nights. It's a good attitude. Husbands shouldn't be going out on business trips the first year. It's not biblically prohibited, but that's the idea the Torah wanted. The Torah even said he doesn't go out to unnecessary wars. If there are wars that aren't obligatory, if they're not life-threatening, so then he stays home. We want him home with his wife. I recommend that couples, for the first year, if he's going to learn, he should have chavrusa at home. The first few months, I recommend they shut their cell phones at night, be together, learn what it is to be with one another. What do you have to be on your SMS and your Facebook and your chats and your all that? Do that the rest of the day. Take the nights and be together. Learn what it is to be together. The Torah wanted couples together to the point where the Torah freed him from his military obligations. The Torah says, when you take collateral, do not take collateral that is the person's livelihood. He can volunteer it, but you can't demand it. Sometimes you figure, you want a loan, you're saying you'll have the money tomorrow, fine. Give me your, if he's a doctor, give me your scalpel. Okay, today scalpels are easy to come by. Let's say he's a security guard. You tell him, give me your gun. Yeah, let's say he's a soldier. You tell him, give me your fatigues. You want to take something that's going to take his livelihood. He's a taxi driver. You tell him, give me your car. The halacha says, no. You may not demand something which is his livelihood. That's his life. The Torah tells us if someone kidnaps someone and makes him work, even the slightest work, he gets the death penalty. The Torah tells us to be careful with the nega tzaras, some kind of leprosy, that we have to go in accordance with what the Kohanim teach us. The Torah gives us a mitzvah to remember what happened to Miriam. This is a mitzvah to be careful with lashon hara. A person has to be careful what he says, not to say something that can in any way be harmful to someone else. How do you gauge that? So the first question you should ask yourself is, would he want me to say it? If I asked him, should I say it, what would he tell me? That's the prohibition of lashon hara. Don't say something that can even though it's in a roundabout way, it can be harmful to someone. The Torah wanted us to be careful what we say. Just as we say every morning, that Talmud Torah keneged kulam, that learning Torah is such a great mitzvah, it carries the weight like all the other mitzvos? Well, the Jerusalem Talmud on that Mishnah says, you want to know which sin carries the weight like all the other sins? That's the sin of Lashon Hara. And it says that if a person holds his mouth shut, and Hashem gave us so many protectors for our mouth, the lips, the teeth, Hashem said you have to cross so many boundaries to get a word out. I tried to help you to keep your mouth shut. But when a person grinds his mouth shut, the Gra says it's like taking two millstones and grinding them together. We know what it feels like when we want to say something. It's on its way out and you're fighting yourself. Remember that the amount of wages Hashem has to give you for that mitzvah, even though it seems simple, it's not, are far greater than anything you can imagine. Hashem looks at you at that moment. It's a test. This is only a test. Remind yourself, what's going to be the big deal if I didn't say it? So, what'll happen? And the truth is, if we think about it deeply, Lashon Hara stems from an unhealthy ego. I want to feel good because I put him down. I know this piece of information that they don't know. And Lashon Hara is like anything else. Although it is a difficult mitzvah, it is a mitzvah that involves habit. If you get into the habit of not saying Lashon Hara, it gets easier with time. And part of the habit is also not to be embarrassed. Not to be embarrassed to say, I can't tell you that, I'm sorry. I can't. And people will sometimes get upset at you, and you have to be able to stand up and say, I'm sorry. If someone told you, I want you to eat pork, you wouldn't be embarrassed. When people want me to say Lashon Hara, very often I say, why don't we go eat pork? I never ate pork in my life. I think that might be more delicious than my telling you this. And you know what? Lashon Hara involves so many averos. Pork is only one. Let's go eat pork. No, Rabbi, you'll eat pork. Well, then why do you want me to say Lashon Hara? Yes? Because of the explanation I gave. Meaning, if you're going to say something that's directly harmful to someone else, you can't do that to a non-Jew either. The idea of Lashon Hara is that you've said something which is indirectly, potentially harmful. It goes beyond the level of slander. Meaning, if you, let's say Jack wants to get a job, and I go to his boss and I say, I wouldn't hire Jack, assuming that he should hire Jack. That's direct harm. That's not Lashon Hara. That's a much higher level. It's also Lashon Hara. But that's something which involves a Jew or a non-Jew. When the Torah prohibits Lashon Hara, what the Torah is saying is, let's say Joe and I are talking, and I say to Joe, you know, that Jack, I wouldn't rely on him for anything. I don't know of Joe contemplating hiring Jack. It's not even on the surface. It's not happening now. But maybe in 2 years, Joe will contemplate hiring Jack. The Torah says, you said something not nice about Jack, right? Right now, there's no overt harm done to Jack. The fact that in the potential, in the future, there will be harm, so that's an extra sensitivity. That extra sensitivity the Torah gave as a mitzvah between the Jewish people. Because it's an extra sensitivity. Direct harm you couldn't do. But if it's an extra sensitivity of what might ensue, so that the Torah gave us. You with me? Mike, yes, no, maybe so? You're not happy. So I said that the gauge is usually what would he want me to refrain from saying. That's usually the gauge. I would add that it's definitely, to my mind, it's clear that within the spirit of the Torah is that you shouldn't say Lashon Hara about a non-Jew either. Because the Torah didn't want us to be that type of person. Just as the Torah doesn't want you to lend a non-Jew with interest, even though you're permitted to, part of the spirit of the Torah is you should be kind to everyone. So then I think it's obvious that part of the spirit of the Torah is that you don't speak slander about a non, you don't say Lashon Hara about a non-Jew either, but I don't think it's the biblical law. I think it's the spirit of the Torah. The Torah wanted us to be positive people who speak positively about everyone. The Torah wanted us to train ourselves not to speak that way about anyone. But it's not a biblical prohibition. It's the spirit of the law, to my mind. It seems to me clear that way, but and I explained the reasoning, but again, I don't think it's the law. I think it's the spirit of the law. You with me?
Going back to the beginning of Parsha.
Right.
Right? I would say before I thought about the table about those verses, to say the same line 19, where we know
I didn't hear you. I didn't hear you.
Say you say something bad about. Say you say, "Oh, I've got a bad feeling about those people in the Nazi Party." It's in the 1930s.
I have bad feelings about the Nazi Party.
About that boy, yeah. And is that Lashon Hara?
Lashon Hara, when it's relevant, then it's important. Then it's not Lashon Hara. So anything that's relevant that people have to know, you have to say, for sure. For sure, if it's something that can harm a person. I had a situation where a friend of mine, I was trying to help a kid I taught get a job.
But the kid was
a thief.
But the Nazi Party was terrorized. Oh, that person, that communist, he was saying bad things about us.
So that's a question. How much do you have to endanger yourself? But when I had this situation, I was trying to help him get a job, but I wanted to ensure it was a job away from the cash register. And when he was about to be hired, I told the guy, "Look, I think you should hire him. I think he has potential, and I don't think he should have any dealings with money. I don't think you can trust him." I gave him as much information as he needed to know so that he wouldn't be harmed by the favor he was doing. Because the halacha says that you have to help your friend, prevent your friend from harm. You can't just turn a blind eye and say, "I'm not saying Lashon Hara." That's not Lashon Hara. When it's relevant, so then you have to say it. But you have to be very smart and know what to say and how to say it. Meaning, let's say you have a friend, and you know this guy has a history of crime. Now he's dating a girl. Who said it's relevant for her to know? If it is relevant for her to know, then you should call up your friend and say, "Look, Jack, you know your history. You have to tell the girl. I had a student a few years ago who had a history of certain issues that a girl had to know. He got engaged and he didn't tell me. He calls me up 3 weeks before the wedding. He has a question about something very, very pious. I said to him, 'I'm sorry for not minding my own business. Before we talk about this level of piety for your wedding, I have a question. Did you tell your kala about your history?' So he said, 'No.' I said, 'Don't you think she needs to know?' He said, 'Yes.' I said, 'So what about telling her?' 3 weeks before the wedding, I felt like 2 cents. But I couldn't let this girl go down an alley she didn't know she was going down. It was a real serious issue that would have real repercussions for her. I don't want to go into it."
"Yeah, I don't know the people."
"Right, okay. Let's say, take my word for it. It was something that was very relevant for her, and he knew it too. So I said to him, 'Don't you think that—' I told him, 'Look, this thing is a thing of piety. Leave me with that. You don't have to do that. You don't have to tell her that. You don't have to deal with that. But this other thing, shouldn't we find a way to share it with your kala?' We sat together for a half hour thinking how he should present it to her. Meaning you don't have to be stupid when you share information. You have to do it in a way that she'll accept it positively. And if I would come and tell her, 'Look, your chassan didn't tell you, but this and this is the case,' no, it's going to blow up the shidduch. If he takes her out and buys her a delicious lunch, and he sits down and has a great atmosphere, and then he finds a way to say it in a nice way, he can obviously present it better than I can. So then it would be Lashon Hara if I would tell her. So then I had to ensure she found out. I had to protect her. But I also had to give him the chance of presenting it his own way. So that's I have situations where I tell guys or girls, if I know these facts, then you have to know that you have to tell me that you told the party before you get engaged. I think it's right to say it before they get engaged. In this case, I had to make sure she found out. I only knew about it after they were engaged. But okay, fine. So that's what we did. Now, if I would have come and I would have jumped the gun and just said, 'I got to tell her it's her own protection,' that would have been Lashon Hara. I have to give him a chance to present himself. But if I would have ignored it, that would have been wrong too. So there's always that balance. And that's why before you go and say something, you should find out halachically what to say, how to say, when to say. You got to do it in the best possible way. If it's short, because we still have a... Yeah.
Right.
Yes. No, you could say it in passing. It's her job to be smart. You don't have to sit her down and say, look, I got something really serious to tell you, which is going to cause you to reconsider our whole marriage. No, you don't have to do that. You can do it in a way that, that she can understand, and it's her job to decide if she's going to look into it or not. Yeah.
Why do you need to waste time for your thoughts?
I didn't follow. That's her job. That's not your job. Once you gave her enough information, and again, discuss with the halachic authority what would be enough information. But you don't have to... one classical thing would be... I don't want to give examples because it's too personal. Meaning for different people, different things are relevant. You don't have to go into all the details. You're right. She might tell herself 2 weeks later, hey, that was very important. And then it's up to her if she wants more information to bring it up.
Did you confirm that it's over?
Yeah.
Okay. How'd you do that?
Good question. I can't give you all my secrets.
That is a good question.
Guys, I'm fighting for you a lot. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to let a girl be hurt by it. I have to fight for both sides. I'm serious. We got to go for what's right. But I also fight for you guys a lot. Don't worry. Okay. The Torah says, what happens if a guy doesn't pay up? So take collateral. The Chafetz Chaim stresses, when you give a loan, take collateral. Meaning, we have a mitzvah to give a loan, and we're not supposed to be stupid about it. Protect yourself. Take collateral. Now, when you come to collect collateral, the guy didn't pay up. So you say, okay, give me collateral. Don't walk into his house and say, huh, that looks nice, that looks nice. No, stand outside, respect his home, and let him bring it out to you. If he invites you inside and says, what do you want? So then you could say, what about those candlesticks? I always say, take collateral that hurts. It doesn't have to hurt, but collateral that he'll want back. Don't let him give you his old laptop that he never plans on using again. If you're going to take collateral, let it be collateral that has teeth. And I say take collateral beforehand. Yeah. Guys come to me all the time here that they lent money and they never got it back and the guy flew the coop. I say don't lend money. If you're going to lend them any money, so then make sure you have good collateral. The Chafetz Chaim says it. You meet a guy, he's your roommate here for 2 weeks and suddenly he says, can I borrow $500? So you want to be a nice guy, you want to lend it to him. I also want you to be a nice guy. But take collateral that has teeth. Take his iPod, take things that he'll want back and he'll pay you back. Don't take his word for it. I wouldn't, and I wouldn't tell you to do it. I'd tell you not to do it. If he gives you as collateral his blanket, then the Torah says bring it back. And the idea here, the Chafetz Chaim explains, is that if every morning he has to bring you back the collateral, and every night he picks it up, at some point he's going to be pretty tired of this and pretty embarrassed. So that's the idea of the collateral. You might say, how much teeth does the collateral have if he gets it back every night? So the idea is, the fact that he brings it back every day is going to be an embarrassment to him, and that'll push him to pay back. The Torah says, he will bless you, and believe me, that'll be good for you before Hashem. And if he doesn't bless you, God says, I will bless you. My father always taught me to value the blessings of people who are down on their luck. Help them out and let them bless you. Give a good tip when you're in the restaurant. Give a good tip to the taxi driver. You need their blessings. The Torah says you have to be careful not to withhold wages. You have a responsibility to pay on time. This applies to every employee you have. You hire a babysitter, pay her on time. It's a biblical mitzvah. If she worked at night, you must pay her before sunrise. If she worked by day, you must pay her before sunset. They risk their lives to help you out to do your work. You have to pay them. You hired a painter. You hired a plumber. You hired someone to do a day job. The Torah demands you pay them that day. What happens if you don't have cash on hand? So you have a problem. Borrow from the neighbor. Don't borrow from the worker. What if the worker's amenable to it? So at least give him a dollar. Give him a shekel. And then the rest of it becomes a loan. But you do have to pay on time. The Torah says, because he risked his life for it. From here we learn that there are levels of risk that you're allowed to take in order to make a parnasa. You are allowed to take certain jobs even though they involve a certain amount of risk. The Talmud describes it as climbing trees to pick fruits. In today's day and age, you have to check, well, what does that mean? Being a security guard in front of a store, doesn't seem like that's too much of a risk. So each job you'd have to verify for yourself. The Torah... Maybe being a drag car racer. Maybe being a... Depends which kinds of stunts you're going to do with cars. That might fall under the category that's too risky. I don't know. I don't know the statistic. I don't know enough about it. I don't know. Right, it's a problem. You're right. But we're short on time, yeah? Usually, yes. Usually, yes. We said it's a laborer that's working for one day. He's working by the month, so then people pay the salary at the end of the month. That's why I gave these examples. Someone who's working that day, he's a painter, he's a plumber, he's working for a day or two, it's not a long-term job. A long-term job has long-term pay. The Torah tells us not to take collateral of a clothing from a widow. Here we have Machlokas, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Chachamim. The machlokas is Darshinan Taima Dekar or not? Are we allowed to apply logic to the psukim and based on that logic define the mitzvah? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai holds that's permissible. And so Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, when the Torah says don't take a garment that's collateral from a widow, it's talking about a poor widow that you'll have to bring it back. People will see you coming to her house every night bringing back her blanket. People are going to start saying not nice things. So the only prohibition, according to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, is when she's a poor widow. What happens if you have a wealthy widow? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai holds you're allowed to take collateral from her. That's a garment, that's her blanket. Because you won't have to bring it back every night, right? And no one's going to say anything. The Torah says, when you harvest and you forget a bundle, don't take it back. Leave it for the poor. That's the mitzvah of shikcha. And Hashem says He will bless you for it. The same thing about when you harvest your olives and your grapevine. Also, if you have peah, if you have the corner of the field, leave that for them. The Torah says when there's an argument, so the courts will punish the wicked. The Torah here gives us the mitzvah of lashes. Anytime a person transgresses a prohibition in the Torah, he gets lashes. Provided that that prohibition is a lav sheyesh bo maaseh, a prohibition that involves an action, and it's not a lav anita klaseh, the prohibition doesn't have an assay to correct it, and a few other details. We say the prototypical prohibition is lo tachsom sho b'disho, meaning the Torah says, we give lashes, and don't muzzle your ox as it's harvesting. So that prohibition of don't muzzle your ox is the prototypical prohibition from which we derive what prohibitions get lashes. They have to be like that, where it involves an action, where it's not a lavanit klase, etc. The Torah says, the rabbis say, if you're threshing with your ox and you're threshing expensive wheat, you don't have to feed the ox from that wheat. You could put him a bucket with barley under his mouth. Let him eat that while he's threshing. The Torah didn't say let him eat from the expensive wheat. The Torah just said don't put on a muzzle. Now putting on a muzzle isn't only a muzzle. If you yell at an animal stops eating because you yelled at it, that's also the biblical prohibition. Here, although sometimes we say speech is not an action, here we say that you're yelling at it involves akimat sfatayim, movement of the lips, which is considered an action. The Torah says we have a mitzvah of yibum. If a person passes away without children, so then there's a mitzvah that his siblings will marry his widow. And when they marry her, we say that that marriage is a continuation of the first marriage. Now this is only when there were no children. There was a terrible thing that happened in Russia where people thought that if a person died with children, then the brothers should marry his wife. Well, you know what? Anyone who did that, their children are bastards. They're mamzerim. The Torah prohibits with the punishment of kares for anyone to marry his brother's wife. And the only time it's permissible and the mitzvah is when the brother died without children. But if he died leaving behind children, then the prohibition still applies. And any brother that would marry her, well, the children they're going to have are mamzerim. The Torah gives a mitzvah for her to marry him. And if he doesn't marry her, then there's the process of chalitza. I'm sorry, we're out of time. We can't have questions now. The process of chalitza involves that They set a time, the courts designate a time and a place the day before. They all meet at that place and they ask him, what do you want? And he says, I don't want to marry her. And she removes his shoe. The shoe represents the body. The body is considered the shoe of the soul. And we say that if he would have married her, so then the children would have been a reincarnation, so to speak, of the soul of the deceased brother. But he didn't marry her. He didn't bring children to the world. And so that soul is not given a shoe to come into the world. That soul is not given capacity to come into the world. So she removes his shoe. And she spits. And his house is called Beit Chalutzanav, the house of one whose shoe was removed. And all the elders declare that is the house of one whose shoe was removed. If you want to see these halachos, it's one siman in Shulchan Aruch. Very fascinating and very simple to understand. We did it a few years ago. The Torah says if two people are fighting and one of the wives comes and grabs the husband in his private parts, you cut off her hand. So we have a tradition, it doesn't mean literally to cover her, cut off her hand, but it means you make her pay for the embarrassment. And here we have the concept that when we pay damages, it involves also a payment for shame. The Torah says you're not allowed to have in your possession weights that are not fair. You are not allowed to own them, even if you don't use them as weights. You use them for a paperweight. You're not using it to sell. The Torah prohibits having in your possession anything that is unjust. And maybe that includes counterfeit money today. God says, I hate that. That is a source of sin. That is a source of thievery. And our parsha concludes with the mitzvah of remembering what Amalek did to us. And Hashem says, when we have peace, we have a mitzvah to appoint a king who will wipe out Amalek from under the sun. Based on this, we have a custom that when a sofer first starts writing, he writes Amalek and crosses it out. The ancient custom of banging during Haman was that they'd write Haman on a stone or on their shoe, and then they'd bang throughout the reading of the Megillah, and that would get erased, a fulfillment of this, erasing the remembrance of Amalek from under the sun. Shabbat shalom.